Ian Buruma has written extensively about contemporary Asian cultures and the interaction between the Eastern and Western worlds, mostly nonfiction, but his latest book, The China Lover, brings him back to fiction, a work of historical fiction, which is published by the Penguin Press. I'm very pleased that it brings Ian Buruma, the Henry R. Luce Professor of Human Rights and Journalism at Bard College, back to the show today. Hi.
Hi, it's good to be back.
The title of this book is The China Lover, but isn't it about a Japanese woman? In fact, it's mostly about Japanese people and Americans.
It is, but this was a state secret during the war in China, in Manchuria, where she was born and grew up, so she was bilingual. And she was picked up by the head spy chief for the Japanese in their puppet state of Manchukuo in northeastern China. To be a star in propaganda movies during the war. And she was cast as a Chinese actress, and her roles were always as Chinese women who fell in love with brave Japanese soldiers and so on. So they didn't want it to be known that she was actually Japanese.
And she didn't look particularly Japanese or particularly Chinese, for that matter.
No, that was part of her appeal, at least in Japan. I mean, the desired effect of the film, of these propaganda movies, that they would convince the Chinese of the Japanese benevolent intentions in China didn't quite work. But she became a huge star in Japan, and very oddly, just as the Japanese were massacring people all over the place in China, there was a little China boom, and China seemed exotic, and she personified this with her exotic looks.
That's part of what you have looked into in this book. First of all, how did you come upon the story of the woman who inspired the book, Yoshiko Yamaguchi, or is it Yamaguchi Yoshiko?
Well, she has many names.
Shirley Yamaguchi, Yoshiko Otaka?
Yes, or Li Xianglan or Li Koran. Well, I was a film student in Tokyo in the 1970s. My uncle was a filmmaker, and I wanted to be a filmmaker, and I'd studied Chinese and fell in love with Japanese cinema and theater. And so I went to Tokyo to be a film student, and I spent a lot of time in their sort of national film theater, and came across these films in festivals on wartime movies and so on, and found it fascinating, this impersonation. The story's been sort of swirling around my head really ever since. I've interviewed her a few times.
Has
still
anybody
alive.
Else have written about her?
In the United States, very few. There is an article in Interview magazine that came out in the 80s, but that was written by me.
And you say she's still alive. She's 88 years old.
Yep.
Is she still active? Because she's had an incredible life. First, it was the acting. Later, we'll get into the fact that she also was a talk show host. She's been a politician. She's been a journalist.
Yes, her life in many ways reflects modern Japanese history. I mean, all its twists and turns, and you'll find that she pops up in some way like a sort of Zelig character almost. So, yeah, I don't know. She's not active anymore, but she, the last time I saw her, which is some time ago, she was still in very good shape, not a wrinkle in her face. And, in fact, one of the very last times I spoke to her was on the phone the day after 9/11. And we chatted, and she said, yep, it's a funny old world.
Well, that was deep analysis. But your last novel, Playing the Game, was published 17 years ago. Why write this as fiction? You could have written it as a biography or a look at history through a woman's story.
I could, but the thing is that her story in Japan is a legend set in stone. There is a musical about her life. There are ghosted autobiographies, various. There are at least one movie about her life. There is a comic strip about her life. There was a TV soap opera about her life. So the last thing she wanted to do is sit down with a foreigner and a tape recorder and depart from the record. So I could have gone into the archives and maybe dug up a few facts that departed from the legend. But I decided the story was so interesting, and not just her story, but actually how people projected their fantasies on her. And that's really the novel.
So that's why you tell a story through three narrators, and none of them are her.
That's right. They're all men in different phases of her life who project what their ideas and their fantasies, their ideals and goals and so on, onto her, and she in some ways is a blank slate for that. And also she's a bit like Lulu in Wedekind, in that it's not clear whether the men think they're manipulating her, but she may actually be manipulating the men.
Are these narrators based on real people too?
They're very loosely based on narrators, yeah, on real people, but I do say loosely, so nobody should read too much into that.
Now, you just said that Yamaguchi may have been a pawn, or she may very well have been a manipulator. And what about these other characters? Were they pawns, or were they real players in history?
Well, they were bit players in history. There are some real players in history in the periphery of the story, such as Kishi, the later prime minister and industrial czar and during the war. But they interest me less. It's the bit players in history that are interesting because they reflect the times a bit more.
Wasn't Yamaguchi once accused of treason after Japan lost the war? Did she play a similar role to the women known as Tokyo Roses?
Well, not quite. She was accused of treason by the Chinese because, of course, they thought that she was a Chinese. And having acted in Japanese propaganda films and entertained Japanese troops and so on, in 45 they arrested her as a traitor. And so she had to very quickly try and find the documentation to prove that, in fact, she was Japanese, and she got off by the skin of her teeth because they were going to execute her.
Well, there were a lot of Japanese in Manchuria at the time. They had a puppet state called Manchukuo. And that has led to all sorts of complications in Japan today. Sometimes when people are going to get married, they try to find out whether the prospective bride or groom is truly Japanese, or are they Korean who...
Well, that's not so much the problem. There are two things. I mean, a lot of Japanese have a certain romantic feeling about Manchukuo, and having been born there gives you a certain exotic appeal, Japanese being born there. What did happen is that they, at the end of the war, when the Soviet troops moved into Manchukuo, the first to escape were the Japanese army and the police, and the people who'd committed the worst atrocities got into the best and first trains out. But they left behind Japanese settlers, farmers and so on, who had been enticed to go there. And they, to the extent that they could escape, often could only do so by leaving their children behind. And those children grew up as Chinese, and they began to trickle back to Japan in the 80s and 90s, and it wasn't a problem, but it gave the Japanese another excuse to feel self-pity.
Your first narrator, Sato, is a Japanese man who speaks of his deep love for China, even as his country is engaging in all of those atrocities that you're describing. And the Japanese presented themselves as the idealistic alternative to Western imperialism, at the same time that they were brutally subjugating the people of Manchuria and then later other parts of China. So how much of it was cynical and how much of it was sincere in their minds?
Well, that's always very difficult to tell with these ideologies. From a literary point of view, I've always been interested in people who've backed the wrong ideals or backed terrible things for noble reasons. And just as there are many people who back the war in Iraq for very noble reasons, for humanitarian reasons and so on.
And there were many communists committed to Stalin while he
absolutely,
was killing
absolutely.
Millions of people, Hitler
absolutely.
As well.
And I think that the same is true for many Japanese in the 1930s and early 40s, that they genuinely thought, and it wasn't entirely crazy, that Western imperialism in Asia was a terrible thing and that Asians needed to be liberated. And some people used this in the Japanese government as a justification for purely national goals, but there were also many who sincere, including many leftists in Manchukuo, who sincerely believed in these goals and fighting the white man and freeing Asia.
My guest is Ian Buruma, whose latest book is a novel called The China Lover. It is published by Penguin Press. So we have Sato, who never feels culpable for any of the terrible things that are happening to the people around him, even though he has his love for China, and Chinese women. And it's interesting that he seems to be exoticizing the Chinese. Now, in America, we would exoticize the Japanese and the Chinese equally.
Well, that's right, because from a Japanese point of view, of course, the Chinese are not the same. And he does exoticize China. And the other element in this, which interested me, is the sexual element, in that domination of another country, whether you're occupying it, as the Americans did in Japan, or whether you're using a country as a puppet state, of course, it has an erotic element. And the idea of, well, literally penetrating a nation is a sort of metaphorical way for also thinking of it erotically.
And women wind up being blamed as well, as we saw in France, where the women who had consorted with the Germans wound up paying a price, even though there wasn't an equality of power.
Yeah, but the Germans had, of course, had a very peculiar attitude. I mean, in the sense that they had this idea of pure race. And so, in fact, it was forbidden to German soldiers, especially in Eastern Europe, not so much in Western Europe, but in Eastern Europe, to consort with local women, let alone Jews.
All three of your narrators have unique sexual stories. Was that part of the original concept? Did you always see this as something that had to do with power on a number of different levels, including sexual
power?
Yes,
absolutely. Except the difference between writing a novel and a nonfiction book is that you try not to have too many preconceptions. I mean, you're not trying to make a case or write a thesis. And so a lot of these things come in the writing, but they do reflect things that I'd been thinking about a lot. And the sexual element in the use of political and military power is something that I had been thinking about.
Well, how much did you want this book to be about the way one culture perceives another?
That's part of it. But, I mean, the main thing that interests me about it are the characters. And I think it's a mistake when you're trying to bring characters to life in a novel to think them too much as representing some kind of an idea, because then they turn into cardboard.
Still, this is very much about things that have historical precedence. The Japanese originally adopted many things from the Chinese, written language, Buddhism, the courtly ways, and then later feel that they have to civilize the Chinese. They were very influenced by American culture, but then felt superior to it, and then after the occupation had to make some kind of accommodation, wound up succeeding partly because they adopted many American ways.
Yes, I mean, this goes back to the middle of the 19th century, when all non-Western countries faced the might of Western imperialism. And the Japanese decided that the only way to resist Western imperialism, resist being colonized, was to learn as much from the West as possible, to westernize and to modernize along Western lines. And then, as the most westernized nation in Asia, to raise the rest of Asia, to liberate the rest of Asia from the West, ironically by exporting their own westernized form of modernization. And so even though the Japanese talked a lot about Asian this and Asian that, a lot of what they were doing in China and a lot of the propaganda was a reflection of their own process of westernization.
There's a subplot involving a Jewish family. There weren't many Jews in Asia, were there?
Well, there were in Manchuria. Harbin, which was a very Russian city, had a large Jewish community of people who'd escaped from the revolution. And Shanghai had a very big community of Jewish refugees. And the Japanese, very oddly, protected them, even when the Germans, the Nazis, were putting pressure on the Japanese to hand them over or to kill them. The Japanese felt that they needed to protect the Jewish communities for peculiar reasons.
Although now anti-Semitism is quite common in Japan, a country that has very few Jews.
Well, yes, but anti-Semitism, as we know, has many faces. And the reason that the Japanese wanted to protect the Jews, ironically, had something to do with anti-Semitism. It's because they bought this notion that the Jews run the world and so on. And so they thought, well, we'd better keep them on the right side.
The story you tell here, Japan is both the occupier and then the occupied. How would you compare Japan's imperialism in China with the way the United States dealt with Japan?
Well, there's no question that the United States, the occupation of Japan by the United States was extremely benevolent by any, if you compare it to any historical.
But we had no clue to the Japanese mindset, did we?
No, but don't forget that although Japan was under the U.S. occupation, it was effectively governed by a Japanese government, by a Japanese bureaucracy, and so on. So that didn't really matter all that much.
So how did Yamaguchi Yoshiko become Shirley Yamaguchi, star of American films like Sam Fuller's House of Bamboo, and later appeared on Broadway, didn't she?
She did indeed in Shangri-La. A musical. Well, she quickly saw the way the wind blew, of course, as many Japanese did. Just after the war, she appeared in Japanese films, a few by Kurosawa, one by Kurosawa, I think, not his best. And she was an ambitious woman. She was a survivor, which is part of the story, that she always knew how to benefit from power. And she realized that the United States was the main power in the world and that it was very much in her interest, as many Japanese did, to become Shirley Yamaguchi and be a hit in Hollywood.
And then later a journalist, a talk show host?
Yes, in the 60s, she had one of the first talk shows, especially for women, on Japanese TV, and specialized in interviewing third world dictators, and justified this by saying she was had been on the wrong side during the war, and now she'd be stand up for the underdog, and ended up talking to likable characters like Idi Amin and Kim Il-sung, and then founded the Palestinian-Japanese Friendship Association after interviewing Leila Khaled, the hijacker. And
So she was on the left?
Well, not really. She was on the side of the Third World. And that could be left, it could be right. There was a faction in the main conservative party that was on that side, and then they took her up and made her into a so-called celebrity MP.
It sounds like an update of the Japanese excuse for the rape of Nanking.
In a way, yes.
Ian Baruma will be giving a talk at the Japan Society this Thursday. Oh, no, Thursday the 16th at 6:30. For tickets, you can go to our show page at wnyc.org. His novel, The China Lover, is published by Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.